Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our community. Hi, I'm Maggie Green, and I'll be your guide on this journey. Now, my goal for this show is threefold. I want to hold space, ask the big and tough questions, and ultimately amplify the voices that need it most. In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. Production snafus, awkward edits, background noise, and because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. All guests have a chance to review the material before it is published so that they can be assured their voices and stories are held and shared with care, treated as sacred things to preserve and pass on. You can find more details about each guest and relevant resources in the show notes for each episode. The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. Hey Weirdos and Queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. If you've been listening for a while, you know those themes are expressed as the mirror, the magnifying glass, and the megaphone, so we'll get to that in just a moment. But you may also recall that some guests choose to remain anonymous. For this first season, the Tragic Optimist Tour, I am delighted and incredibly grateful to share that all guests in this season have chosen to share their identities, including today's guest. Now, before I tell you who they are and reveal their identity, a few things to know about this person. First, he uses he/him pronouns. He is a congenital right-hand amputee. He grew up gay in a working-class family and says that his experience helped him develop in a few ways, thinking beyond the experience of those around him, finding his own solutions to common issues, and reaching beyond the confines of his environment. It was only possible, he says, because his body was different, and his heart was different. His name is Kevin. Kevin, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to have you on the show. Would you mind taking a few moments to introduce yourself to the listeners out there?
Hi, Maggie. As you mentioned, my name is Kevin, and you did a really good job of talking about kind of the formative bits of me. And I think it's really important because as a congenital amputee, I've had to look at the world in a very different way than I think the average person or the common person. And also growing up in a working class family, there are values and there are experiences that are unique. So as I approach 60, I can reflect on this and think how all of this has kind of made me the person that I am today, and kind of the way I approach life and the way I approach problems and the way I approach relationships. It's something I'm really grateful for, actually, the unique experiences and the way that my physical person and my emotional person have fit into the family that I was born into and the people that I surround myself with now.
I love that. Beautiful introduction. And
actually a really great segue into our first segment, the mirror. So the theme, the concept behind the mirror, of course, is self-awareness, self-reflection. And the question really here is, what important insight have you learned about yourself? What makes you uniquely you? Of course, you've shared a bit in your introduction. You mentioned in our pre-interview, boundaries specifically, one of my favorite topics. I'm so excited to hear what you'd like to share. Maybe your understanding of boundaries, how that's played out in your life. Tell us a little bit about boundaries.
Well, I'd love to thank my therapist for helping support those boundaries. First of all, I think, you know, being in therapy for a number of years, it's been incredibly helpful for me to kind of not to really contextualize all the things that I think, all the experiences that I've had, try to figure out where all these things fit and how to actually use them as tools. And boundaries are something that I've been aware of for many, many, many years. I grew up in a family where there weren't a lot of boundaries, and I learned how to set them at a very young age, although I didn't know that I was doing it. It wasn't until many years later that I figured out that this is what I was doing. You know, I had a family. My parents were married for 45 years. My father worked in a factory. My mother worked in a factory, and you know, they supported the family. But there were very few boundaries when it came to behavior in terms of how we interacted with one another. There were favorites in the family, and you know, there was a dynamic there. And when I was in my late teens, I finally decided that the favoritism wasn't working for me. And that if I'll give you the story that kind of set all this off, I had moved into my first apartment and I invited my parents over to have pizza one Sunday. And my mother called at the last minute and said that they were going to be late because she was going to give my brother a haircut. My brother's always been the favorite. So I told her, don't bother coming, that, you know, we had plans and she decided that something else was more important, so that she should continue on with the plans that she had made with my brother. And that was like the first boundary that I set with my mother. And I wasn't angry and we didn't fight. She was upset. And it was 6 months before I was able to see her in person. Wow. I was hurt by that. And I didn't know what to do with it at 19, 20. I didn't know what to do with all that, but I knew that this was not something that was acceptable, right? I mean, I'm the youngest of three children. My brother was the middle child, is the middle child, and she clearly had a favorite. And I look back on it now, and it's less emotional as an adult than it was when I was young and trying to set those boundaries. Being able to express to my mother, who was a very strong personality in the family, and tell her no was a big deal. It was a big deal for me, but it was also a big deal for the rest of the family.
Yeah.
And it kind of shocked me.
It kind of helped me get inside your head a little bit in that pivotal moment where you're, you know, clearly you had processed and kind of thought ahead, like, this is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. You know, how did it feel from an emotional standpoint in that moment as you were communicating that to her, and also kind of the aftermath of that? Which you suggest, obviously, you know, it impacted other people other than you and your family as well.
Well, I remember being calm about it and just saying, no, you don't come. If you're not going to come at the time that we had agreed for dinner, then don't bother coming at all. And she was shocked, and my father was shocked, because nobody ever said things like that to my mother. My brother, I have no idea what his response was, but you know, it was one of these things that I don't think anybody in the family really understood that they could say no, right? When my mother got something in her mind and she did what she did. And, you know, I do want to say my mother was a very loving person, and I grew to have a very, very close relationship with her after this, which is one of the things that I think is really important to remember, that in my life, boundaries, setting those boundaries are very, very important, maintaining close relationships. Because I wasn't as resentful once I started setting those boundaries. You know, I was perfectly happy saying, we had plans and you changed them, and that's okay. You made your decision, and so I'm going to go on with my day. And 6 months later, when we started talking again, it was much more respectful. And she never behaved like that with me again. We were always very clear with our plans. We were always very clear with where we stood with one another. And I appreciated that because, you know, my mother and I were very, very close after that. And then I came out, like I'd come out like the year before, but then she and I started talking about my dating and my volunteer work and things like that. And that was the first kind of boundary setting. But then, you know, something much lower stakes for me was that my mother was a smoker and I didn't allow smoking in my car. And I was the only one who could get her not to smoke in the car, which
Wow.
was really interesting. And, you know, I would be very clear with her. I'd say, I'm happy to stand outside the car while you smoke a cigarette before we get in. And, you know, then we can be on our way. And she would look at me and push a little. And I'd say, well, you know, the rules, it's my car and you can't smoke in my car. So let's talk while you smoke outside. And so that first issue where we were setting boundaries, where I was setting boundaries, was much more fraught than the subsequent boundary setting, right? It was much easier because I had already shown that I wasn't going to let my boundaries be crossed like that. I mean, she's allowed to smoke. I didn't ever told her not to smoke, but I don't want the smoking in my car. And so there's a compromise here, and I'm happy to the compromise. I don't want to, you know, tell you to stop smoking, but here's my limit, right?
You made reference to behavior early on and favoritism as far as the dynamic in your family. As you mentioned behavior and we're thinking about boundaries, I don't know if it's clear to everyone who might be listening, but I think maybe it's worth clarifying. Boundaries are like self-imposed limits, right? They're your own threshold. They're your responsibility. You own them as far as establishing them, nurturing them, upholding them. And just for a point of clarification, right? Boundaries are not a means of controlling the behavior of others. There may be changes in behavior as a consequence, right? The company that you keep based on, you know, their reaction and interaction with those boundaries. Yeah, I thought I might mention that again, a point of clarification, because it can be confusing. Like I've seen a lot of conversations online, heard a lot of conversations in my life, both personal and professional, where it's not exactly clear, like what is a boundary and what is not a boundary. And I think your example of smoking in the car is a wonderful example, and you further kind of reiterated that by saying like, I'm not going to tell you not to smoke, right? That's your choice. Those are her behaviors, but your boundary is that these are the rules of this vehicle. That's my car. I don't allow smoking in here. So, is there anything that you might want to share about that? Like, how did you figure out what boundaries were, even to begin establishing them?
You know, the funny thing is, I don't know. At the time, I didn't know, and I don't know where all that came from. And, you know, as an adult, I can kind of point to the fact that, you know, I've always had to make my own way anyway. I mean, even though my parents were supportive and loving, and I'm very close to my dad, and I was very close to my mom after the initial boundary setting. I think because I've always been part of, but not completely. I don't know if this is the right way to put it. Because I'm gay, because I was born with one hand, there were no shortcuts in my family, right? Everything was something I had to think about, you know, how to do certain things, how to participate with the family. And nobody was ever excluding me, but at the same time, I still had to find my own ways of doing things. And so I think that when it came time to setting boundaries, I had always done those things anyway. I always thought slightly differently than the rest of the family. And so maybe that all prepared me for saying, this is how the family dynamic works, but I have an option here. I don't need to follow the family dynamic. In fact, I can find my own way, as I've always been finding my own way.
Yeah, you're an individual as much as you are part of this
That's
whole, right?
Exactly.
That is really, really interesting. You know, I appreciate what you said too in the notes as we were preparing for this. You know, boundaries and expectations are key to a happy life. They're also the hardest to identify and keep. Just with respect to boundaries, and maybe this is in your personal life or professional life, have you witnessed or experienced those again, like self-imposed limits, expectations, aka boundaries. Have you experienced an evolution of those things? Like, were there instances where you changed a boundary, or a boundary was different than when it was first established? And also, how do you navigate interacting with others around that? Like, once that changes, how do you communicate that? How do you manage your own expectations and theirs, let's say?
Well, that's a really great question. And I can talk a little bit about expectations and how they relate to boundaries in my professional life first. I have been in customer service and technical support since the 90s, the early 90s. So it's been decades. And that's where the phrase setting expectations is the key to a happy life comes from. It comes from my experience talking to people on the phones and some people who are very unhappy. I remember in my very, very first job supporting Microsoft Word for DOS 2.0. So this is many, many decades ago.
The nostalgia, wow.
I know, right? And there was a, you know, when I joined the team, there was a story going around or a warning that there was a particular customer who would call and inevitably she would yell and be abusive and either hang up on you or, you know, in one case, one of my coworkers ended up in the ladies' room crying after one phone call. And you know, eventually it was my turn to talk to her. And at this point, I had fairly good, like, emotional armor. I could put it up and realize that, you know, people who are frustrated are not frustrated with me. And so I didn't really take those things personally, even at a young age. And of course, the customer called and we were talking, and I asked her a simple question: what version are you using? And she couldn't tell me. And she got a little short, and a little upset. And I said, I can show you. It's easy. And I showed her. And at the end, I said something like, now, anytime anybody asks you, you have the information. And it dawned on me after that conversation that her behavior was really kind of a reaction to not being in control, not having all the answers, needing somebody else's help. And that was a great early revelation because it helped me maintain the emotional armor when people were upset, when people were angry or whatever. And this all comes into boundaries. The first is setting expectations. So I can set the expectation that I'm happy to help. And the other thing is when someone asks a question or describes a symptom, is usually what's happening in a tech support call, I can say, here's the limits of my ability to help. I can help you through this, this, and this. But if it gets to that point, we're going to have to get some additional help for us, right? And that kind of leaves a breadcrumb. And that sets an expectation that I'm not guaranteeing I have all the answers here, right? Very, very important. And so when we get to that point, I can easily say, remember when we first started the call and I said, if we get to this point, you know, whatever. And I was able to escalate those calls very easily. When people become abusive, that's when the boundaries come in, right? If someone is swearing, but they're swearing at the ether, right? They're using swears as an adjective. That's perfectly fine. If you're frustrated, express your frustration. But if it becomes personal, that's the boundary. Like, then, you know, sir or ma'am or whomever, usually by name, the language that you're using toward me is unacceptable. And if it happens again, I'll disconnect the call. Very simple.
Yeah,
And it
I'm
works.
not willing to participate at that level. I'm not gonna take that shit. Yeah.
Nope. It was many, many years later when I saw the movie Mommy Dearest, and I use this as an example with people in my department all the time. There's a great scene where Joan Crawford is waiting for someone to come and interview her in her home, and she's dressed. She has a beautiful dress on. She has heels on. She has pearls, and she walks into the foyer and she asks the maid, "Did you clean under the flower pots in the foyer?" And then she says, "Never mind, I'll do it." And she takes the rag and she moves the pot, and she's on her hands and knees scrubbing under the flower pots that she just moved because there's dirt under them. And she looks at the maid and says, and I'm paraphrasing, I think, "I'm not mad at you, I'm mad at the dirt," which is a really interesting thing to say. Because when I use this example with people who I talk with and who I'm coaching, I ask them to remember to distinguish between people being mad at you and mad at the dirt. If they're mad at you and you've had, and, you know, you're just trying to help them, then you can set that boundary. If they're mad at the dirt and they just need to vent in someone's direction, long as it's not personal, you know, you can decide whether or not you've had enough. That's up to you. But just remember that they're not always mad at you. And nothing wrong. You're trying to help. They don't always understand that. But I think it's really important for people to hear that, to say, you know, learn the distinction between people who are mad at you and people who are mad at the dirt, because it'll save you a lot of anguish or frustration or emotions that are not necessary in a particular situation. It's easier to let something roll off you when you realize it's not about you.
Absolutely. Definitely the phrase, like, it's a them problem, not a you problem, comes to mind. Like, having that, like you said, distinction, separation. This is actually not about me. It's about the thing. It's about the dirt. It's about the piece of technology or my lack of information or whatever it might be. That's really, really helpful. I also think if you're the king of segues here, because you had mentioned your history with customer service. And as we're moving into the magnifying glass segment, you were talking a lot about communicating with people and that there were specific characteristics or principles maybe that you come into that environment with to make it more successful for all parties concerned. The magnifying glass segment, right, is all about the details, deep knowledge in the weeds, like looking at something really closely. And you had mentioned empathy and kindness. But what is the role that those play, especially when you're navigating the world of expectations, and angry customers and colleagues or whatever that situation is. Tell me a little bit more about that.
There's a lot to say. I will say that I have a phrase that I use a lot. I'd rather be thought of as kind over nice. And I think it's really important for me to project kindness. Because kindness is not always what someone wants. Sometimes it's what they need, or sometimes it's kindness is what you need to do for yourself. Nice can be fake. Nice can be a show, but kind is something that is felt. And so I think it's really important. And I say that obviously to people around me all the time because it is just so important, and it's something that is just lacking in so many experiences, especially today. But it's critical. We can't live without kindness. I think, one example of kindness. I had major surgery about a year and a half ago, and we had to decide whether to tell my father, who has Alzheimer's, and he's still very much with us, luckily. His disease is not that progressed that he doesn't know what's going on around him, but he does have trouble sometimes processing information. So we had to decide whether to tell him that I had major surgery coming up. And we decided that it was kinder not to, because he would just worry without anywhere to put that worry. And I'm not sure that it was the right decision or the wrong decision. I don't know. But that's what I felt was the kindest thing to do. And so that's what we did. And then afterwards, I sat him down and told him what had happened and what the surgery was about and how successful it was. And there's really no need to worry, but only after the fact. And I think so, it was really important for me not to push worry onto my father, who couldn't process it in a way that would be productive, that would it would just be harmful for him.
There's the key word is the harmful piece. As you were sharing, I was thinking about, all similar situations where I've had to make a decision, usually about disclosing or not disclosing information to a person. It's like, and if you approach it with kindness, if you approach the situation with empathy, is giving them this information going to hurt them? Just full stop? Or is there another place to go beyond that? Is there a reason? What might they do with that pain? Like all of these things go through my mind. And if it's about like unburdening for yourself, that is something totally different than when you actually share it with another person. So, having to decide, do I keep this to myself, even though it's uncomfortable and I really want to share, or it's exciting and I really want to share, if this is going to cause upset or harm to the other party, it's probably best not to. You revisit it at a different time.
But it's also important to give yourself some grace. In some circumstances, there's no really evident best answer. It is just the best that we can do at the moment. And, in hindsight, you may have to rethink whether that, the decision you made was the best. But grace is also very important to give yourself. If you're doing things for the right reason, if you're doing things, and it doesn't work out the way that you'd hoped, it's okay to give yourself some grace and give others grace to understand what's going on. And, not to carry so many burdens. We always carry, we all carry so many burdens as it is, and some of them we don't have to. And it's important to know the difference.
The other kind of principle or value that comes to mind is compassion, where there is empathy, where there is kindness, you're probably going to find compassion close by. I'm thinking about angry customer calls. Like, compassion is a means of kind of putting yourself in their shoes, trying to understand things from their perspective. And this goes back to the separating what's their shit and what is yours to own, internalizing or not internalizing whatever stress or upset they might be experiencing. I think that's really interesting. It's super important. And the other thing you had mentioned in our notes as well is like not only treating others with these values, but expecting them as well. How in the world do you navigate life with that expectation when maybe not everyone around us has those values?
That is so hard. It is so hard. It's easy to become disappointed with people who do not behave as you would have behaved toward them. It's easy to be disappointed, but it's also futile because not everyone is going to be you, and not everyone is the same place, is in the same place that you are. And so expecting, having expectations of other people's behavior is really not always the best. It doesn't always have the best outcome. But that's where grace comes in. That's where compassion comes in. And also, again, boundaries. There are plenty of people in my life who I've just had to say, we are going to be so close, and that's it. We're going to have so much interaction, and that's it. And I'm okay with that. And however you interpret that, or however, you can be kind, but not extend yourself to someone who's going to generate some feelings in you that are not productive. We're in control of how we spend our time. We're in control of who we spend our time with. And it's an ongoing process to figure out the best mix of that.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.
For some context for folks maybe who missed the memo, our original plan was to have this conversation live and in person when we're together in a shared physical space, as we were just several weeks ago. And I remember anticipating the visit. Was very excited, and there's some internal pressure, like, you made this commitment, we're going to do this recording. And as I'm thinking about grace and kindness, extending that to others, but also to yourself, I remember very vividly in the moment, like on the fly, kind of building in some more flexibility for myself. And it was in that moment, I was like, I really would just rather kind of kick it with you. Like, can we have this special one-on-one time? Right? We can do the podcast anytime. But in that moment, it was like I needed to let go of that pressure. I needed to let go of some of the expectations for our interactions. And ultimately, it was a kindness to myself because, frankly, I was physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted. What I really needed was, to hang out, to swap stories, and just be with each other and present in the moment. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but that's a very strong kind of visceral retrospective there. I'm like, oh, these things actually were happening in real time relative to our time together too.
I'm so glad we were able to hang out for a little while. I'm so glad that we didn't have the pressure of producing at that moment, because it was later on in the day. You were very tired. I was a little tired. And it was the first time we were actually in the same room together. So had we recorded the podcast, that would have been wonderful. But in retrospect, I'm so glad that we were able to just relax and, enjoy each other's company, because it was so enjoyable. It was so lovely to sit and talk with you and like you said, exchange stories and find out how your trip was going. And it was a lovely experience.
I definitely learned a lot through that experience and even today's conversation too. I feel like I always learn something from you when we talk, which thank you for being flexible, for being willing to, adapt and kind of go with the flow. I'm really glad that we got to actually do this as planned, even though, the physical environment and circumstances are slightly different. I can see some boundaries at play.
And, we were communicating all through, right? You and I were texting, figuring out what we were going to do. At the very least, we were going to sit down and talk and have something to eat and just enjoy each other's company. And that was great to be able to say to each other, here's what we need. Here's what's going on. Here are the changes that are going on. How can we continue to adapt? And I'm so glad that you gave yourself that level of grace and built in some of that because we had a wonderful time. We had a wonderful visit, and now we're having a nice conversation.
Absolutely. No regrets. Something else that's come up through this conversation is communication. It's spoiler, who's what I studied in college. In every job interview I've ever had, it's been my position like communication is the foundation of everything. Most other skills can be learned or taught. Communication is key. When it comes to boundaries, approaching people with empathy and kindness, like, this is how it happens. Communication is where that magic takes place. And your communication skills, I've always admired you for that. I'm curious if you want to talk a little bit about communication, its importance, the impact it can have, maybe where it goes wrong.
Yeah, sure, we can talk about that. But first of all, thank you. It was very nice of you to say those things. My communication is not always 100%. There's always a level of anxiety with certain people or with certain situations. And how much I can overcome that anxiety will determine whether or not I communicate everything I need to. And again, this is about setting expectations and setting boundaries and communicating all of that, but also overcoming whatever's going on inside me at the time. There are certain people who make me anxious and some people who don't. And knowing that about myself and accepting it allows me to kind of either communicate better in the moment or know that I need to take a step back and communicate in a different way at a different time. But communicating with other people, but also communicating with myself, right? Trying to be as honest as I can about what's going on in the moment with certain people. Relationships are hard. Interpersonal relationships are really, really hard. And they're not one thing, as we know. There are different ways of communicating with different people. And it is, I need to be blunt with this person. Sometimes I need to be gentle with this person. Sometimes I need to not interact with this person or some person. And knowing that and being aware of it is a real hard thing to be consistent about. But that's what therapy is for. That's what introspection is for. That's what learning from my mistakes is for, right? Always being open to learning from my mistakes, not ruminating on all the mistakes I've made, but how could I have been better in the future? And what can I do? How can I identify when things are going wrong? How can I identify a situation that may not go the way I want it? What can I do to make the situation better from the beginning? There's so many things that are going on in the moment when I'm communicating with somebody, whether I know them or not, whether I know their style or not, whether I'm comfortable or not. So many things going on. I am not a professional communicator. I'm a professional talker, or at least I used to be. I haven't been on the phones in years, but as a director level person, my job right now is relationship building, not necessarily communicating to customers, but building relationships with the people who work on my team, building relationships with people who I work around and work for and work with. Rather than discrete conversations that last 3 to 5 minutes, I now have ongoing relationships that I have to build. And not, they're not always smooth. Many of them are, because I work with wonderful people, but not all of those relationships are easy or smooth or as productive as I want them to be. And I have to figure out how to do it. That's my job.
I definitely feel that, and something that we have in common is anxiety. It's something that I struggle with every day, every minute of every day. And when it comes to, like you were describing, like interacting with certain people or strangers or, certain high stakes environments, that anxiety level will fluctuate. As you were sharing, I was thinking about that too. Like in the moment, you're talking about all these things that happen internally. And just on the subject of communication, so there's what comes out to whoever your intended recipient or audience might be. What does that internal monologue look like when you were, let's say, when you feel anxiety heating up and you know you need to sort of de-escalate to get in the mode that you need to be in to deliver whatever message? I understand from personal experience that this is happening like in real time, but fire, like so quickly. But if we could put it in slow motion, can you talk a little bit about what happens internally? Like, how do you psych yourself up for delivering a message that gives you anxiety, or delivering a message to a person that maybe makes you feel anxious, or a situation? How do you
Ooh.
talk yourself down?
Sometimes I talk myself out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I realize I'm just not in a place to have a conversation like this. I'm not prepared, or I'm not in an emotional place. I'm not in a position to advocate for the people I need to advocate for. So I don't have that conversation, and I wait until a different time. Sometimes the conversations can't wait. And so there are lots of different ways my anxiety would present itself. One is if I'm not as knowledgeable about what I need to talk about. What is my level of knowledge? Am I trying to get information from somebody, or am I trying to share what I know, or am I trying to make a decision and solicit agreement? Like, it really depends on the nature of the communication. And if I don't know as much as I want to know, or if I don't think I have enough information, my anxiety can spike because it's easy for someone else to control that interaction if they appear or are more knowledgeable about the topic. And even if the whole purpose of the communication is to get knowledge, if I feel like I don't have enough to even enter the conversation, if I'm not worthy enough to enter the conversation, my anxiety can spike that way. It's easy enough to go back and do more research and be more prepared. But some interactions with some people are designed to cause anxiety. I think of a situation many, many years ago where I was trying to advocate my position on a technical direction, and the person who was the most talkative in the meeting asked a series of questions that had no real bearing on the outcome. And I realized afterwards that it was a tactic. It was a blocking tactic. If you can ask a question that has no real good answer, you can discredit the message that's coming from the person you're asking.
Sneaky.
Very sneaky. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I had an ally at the time, and we kind of debriefed after that. And I'm like, you know, this is what I think was happening here. And let's be on the lookout for that in the future. And let's have a counter to that. If somebody's asking a blocking question, in this particular case, it was a system that we were advocating for. And the question was, can the system do X, which had nothing to do with anything we needed? And the answer was no. And so that discredited our use of the system that we were advocating for, because the answer was no to an unnecessary feature. So being prepared for those kinds of things is really important to reduce anxiety. And so I've learned over the years, certain techniques and certain triggers. I've learned more about myself when I get triggered in certain ways. And I've learned more about how to identify things and overcome them. Certainly not perfect, and I'll never be perfect at it, but I'm better at it than I used to be.
Yeah, we're all learning and growing. As long as we're alive, we have that opportunity. I don't think anyone has it all figured out. But, I was thinking about the situation you were describing, a lack of knowledge or perceived lack of knowledge or information. That definitely resonates. And what do you do in that situation? I was thinking about kind of all the other pieces that we've mentioned, like empathy, kindness, boundaries. It's actually okay. I don't know if this is true in every situation, but to say, I don't have an answer for that right now, or I'd like to come back to you once I've had an opportunity to gather some more information so that we can make an informed decision together, or whatever that might be. I don't know if that helps or hurts anxiety, because I certainly have experienced anxious feelings in communicating that type of message.
Absolutely. And if the person that you're talking with is not acting in good faith, then it can throw me off even more.
Right.
And so I think that's a really important thing that I've tried to distinguish between good faith and bad faith conversations or comments or direction. I think it's really important. If someone is acting in bad faith, then nothing I say will make a difference. And so what is the strategy there? In some cases, it's a direct challenge. Why is that feature important in this conversation? Would I have the presence of mind back in that original conversation to say things like that? No, absolutely not.
Always in retrospect, hindsight.
Always. But I think it's because my default is good faith. If someone asks me a question, I'm going to consider that question in good faith, right? And that's not always the way to handle something. And my anxiety would sometimes block me from understanding the difference between a good faith question or comment and a bad faith comment in the moment.
Oh yeah, that resonates too. Like I can feel like the physical sensation of like, not quite panic, anxiety as a spectrum, but like, yeah, it is what it is. A therapist would say, like even acknowledging your anxiety as a separate entity, like this is my brain influenced by this. I'm not thinking 100% clearly. I'm not fully rational in this moment. It's the anxiety talking. It doesn't know the difference. It's like, you mentioned armor earlier. It's like, all right, let's suit up. Let's gear up. We're ready for battle. It's
And
ready.
it's much easier on, let's say, a phone call with a customer because I know I'm the one in control here. I have the skills to direct the conversation. I know what questions to ask. I know what tone to use. And I know what my boundaries are. Not so with peers, not so with people who are not coming at me for an answer. So there's a certain dynamic on a phone call with a customer that does not exist in a conversation during a meeting with coworkers or family members or acquaintances, right? It's a different dynamic. And so anxiety can rear its head in different ways in those situations.
I think you made another really good point. Like you mentioned control. When I think about anxiety, when I've talked to with therapists, with people who experience anxiety, that's what it is. That's what it boils down to is control. And the level of anxiety that you experience can fluctuate with how much, if any, control you have over a situation, over your own emotions, whatever that might be. It's an interesting connection. I'm glad that came up. Yeah, you also use the word advocate a few times, which brilliant segue into the megaphone segment, which is all about advocacy. Considering everything that we've talked about today, your experience in customer service, your experience with disability, sexuality, otherness, feeling that way as you were growing up, what is a message or a movement? Maybe it's a specific organization. In the spirit of advocacy that you feel needs amplification, a bigger spotlight is close to home for you. Is there anyone or anything that you would like to call out?
The Allie Forney Center in New York. It is a center for homeless queer youth. They offer shelters, but also education assistance and healthcare in some way. And it's just an amazing organization that has been helping queer kids for a long, long time. I should say queer youth because I'm not sure what the upper age limit is. But when families abandon their children, it is heartbreaking in and of itself. But to have an organization that at least is trying to do something to help get some kind of service, to get some needs met in the moment, I think is really critical. And to do it with dignity and kindness and take all people as they come. And so, I've supported Allie Forney Center personally for a long time. And I wish everyone would. I think it's an amazing organization that has done such good work for so long. It deserves some recognition and lots of support.
Thank you for sharing about them. That's the Allie Forney Center in New York City. We'll definitely include a link to the organization, some information so that listeners can learn more about that. The other thing I was thinking of, because specifically it's located in New York City, and I know a little bit about you, we've had a chance to get to know each other over these last several years. You have a bit of a personal connection and affinity for NYC. I would love to hear your reflections on New York, what it means to you personally, if that's something that you're willing to share.
Oh, of course, of course. I have wanted to live in New York City all of my life, and I was able to do it for a number of years. I moved to New York City for a job in 2003, and my first apartment in Manhattan was on West 69th Street between Central Park West and Columbus. And I can't imagine my good fortune. I was taking a job that was based in Soho, and the person was leaving for graduate school. So I was able to take his rent stabilized apartment at the same time. The experience was just was one of a kind. It was a very small building, very small apartment, steps away from Central Park, steps away from the subway, and it was already 30 something, 34, somewhere around there. So I wasn't a young person, I wasn't an old person, and I was able to experience so much of New York City. And I'm not somebody who goes to clubs and, but I do love art. I do love museums. I love walking down the street and seeing an artist selling his or her or their art on the street and looking at things that I had not seen before. It's just one of those places where everyone is there and there are so many wonderful experiences. I was there for the blackout, and because I
Wow.
lived on the first floor, I didn't have to worry about like dragging things up and down lots of stairs. But my partner at the time, he and I went to Central Park and we're going to get a hot dog off a cart because there was no electricity anywhere and those carts are self-sufficient. So we got there and we were at the promenade and we're eating our hot dogs and drinking our soda and we hear the Indigo Girls performing in the amphitheater with no amplifiers. And everyone who was at the event was just singing the songs together. And it's one of those kind of magical New York moments, sitting under a tree on a bench in New York City in Central Park, listening to the Indigo Girls and everyone singing along. And as we're walking through the rest of the city, we're seeing bodegas giving out free water because they didn't have electricity to keep it cold anyway, and people were walking home. And so the kindness and generosity of New Yorkers, the people helping each other, it's just a magical, magical place. I'll give you one other anecdote about the crazy, magical New York that I know. One Sunday morning, I was walking through sort of the lower part of Chelsea, and I'm walking up Sixth Avenue and I see a playground. And there's a sign on the fence that said, "Mime entrance this way."
Okay.
It was a Sunday morning. It was like 7 a.m. And there was a tent outside of which stood a line of mimes. And I have no idea what they were doing. I have no idea why they were there, but it seemed to me a perfectly New York moment.
That is amazing. One of the things that came to mind as you were sharing there, you know, at every region, every state, every culture has some associated stereotypes. I think about the Northeast and this perceived penchant for brusqueness or rudeness or like maybe lack of compassion or empathy. Like the stories that you've shared, even down to the organization that you mentioned, like what a rich sense of community showing up for one another. You know, the community sing along with the Indigo Girls in the park. That's so cool. I have not spent any time in New York City. All I know about it is what I've seen on TV and seen in movies and read about and heard stories about. But yeah, that is fantastic. It's
It's
encouraging.
magic. It
Yeah,
really is.
it's given me some different perspective. So thank you for that as well. As we are wrapping up here, one of the notes I kind of always like to end on is we have all this information that we've shared today, things that we've learned about ourselves, about each other. What do we do about it? If listeners come to this conversation and they're like, okay, so now I know what boundaries are. I know the importance of communication, expectation setting, the role of empathy, kindness, compassion. What do I do now? What's my next step? Do you have any advice or actionable insights that you might leave with listeners? Anything they can kind of take with them and put into practice following this conversation.
If nothing else, community. Finding someone to share your thoughts and your anxieties or your needs with. Finding some way to contextualize what you're hoping for. That could be therapy, which I found incredibly useful over the years. It can be a community of people who are like you or you gravitate toward and people that you trust. But I think that that's really the key to everything. Finding some way of expressing and figuring out where you are and where you want to be and how to get there.
That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this, your voice matters.